It is 8:30, and you are listening to Mind Over Matters here on KEXP 90.3 FM Seattle. And we have with us in the studios, alive and kicking, both John Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, co-editors at Eat the State. How are you both this morning?
We're having plumbing problems.
Both of you.
Actually, yeah. Uh-huh. Right. Other than that, great.
Yeah, pretty good.
Good, good.
Considering.
All right, well, we'll get rolling on this first item, and then I'll go call the plumber. So they were talking about Homeland Security issues on Counterspin and doing some good coverage there. A little bit of coverage in the media this week. I was psyched to see that both our senators gave a big thumbs up.
including Maria Cantwell, our senator for the information ages, the one who's really concerned and fighting for us to protect our privacy, just the way she did at Real Networks. As you'll recall, that was kind of an issue during the campaign because she made that a big cornerstone of her campaign, even though while she was a vice president at Real Networks, the company got an enormous amount of hot water for basically privacy issues. And that is kind of a microcosm of now what is going on for the federal government. Oh, there goes Mike looking for the plumber. I guess we better just
keep
talking
for a
while.
We can take over the show.
Hey, how about that? So anyway, talking about Mike's private life. No. whoops, here he comes. It's been a very, very frightening week coming out of Washington, D.C. for any number of reasons, and some other places too. One of the things, I've actually got a whole laundry list on the workingforchange.com site of different privacy and civil liberties related issues. Welcome back, Mike. Have gone down in the last week, and that also included an appeals court in San Francisco that threw out a lawsuit that was filed as a class action on behalf of Guantanamo Bay defendants by a federal judge, saying that only the Guantanamo Bay defendants, who of course don't particularly have good access to legal counsel, would have standing to sue the federal government in federal court. So it hasn't been a real encouraging week for that kind of stuff. We had the no-fly zone. We had the no-fly list being confirmed after getting anecdotal reports for a number of months from various political activists, usually of the left-leaning variety, that apparently there was some sort of list being circulated of activists to watch out for who had, you know, basically unpatriotic Nixon enemies list type politics that somebody was concerned about.
That's people who present themselves to get on flights.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what the no fly. What he means by no fly?
Yeah, that the people who came to airports were then pulled out and either given extensive questioning and searching and grilling, or simply not allowed to fly at all.
A lot of people who bought their tickets ahead of time.
Yes, and who did not get those tickets refunded, because of course some of the airlines say, well, that's a non-refundable ticket. So there was that. There was the appeal in our top secret federal surveillance court that we didn't even know existed until last, I believe it was May, when they very surprisingly was among the first of the several federal courts to start slapping down John Ashcroft's conception of civil rights during a time of alleged, at least anecdotal, war. And then we found out this week that there's also an appeals process to that top secret federal court, and that the appeals process, in fact,
has never been used until now.
Had never been used until now, and in fact, for all we know, wasn't even invented until now. But it did, in fact, vindicate John Ashcroft, which in turn greatly, that was one of the disputed portions of the USA Patriot Act that had not been implemented, that we know of anyway, but is because it raised a couple constitutional questions, the top secret appeals court found in favor of the federal government for that reason. And so now the federal government has vastly expanded powers to not only wiretap and monitor email and all that kind of good stuff, but also to conduct what are euphemistically, it's always a euphemism these days, isn't it, entitled sneak and peek searches, which means that they can sneak into your home and peek into your possessions, and that includes your computer, hard disks, and whatnot, and not ever tell you. And they don't need any kind of a warrant to do it. You know, they can just do it as part of an investigation. And because Ashcroft also rewrote the regulations for the investigations don't have to be for any suspected criminal wrongdoing. They can just be because they don't like your religion or your politics.
And I understand they can do that at your workplace, too. And if one of your coworkers notifies you that that happened, that they can suffer massive penalties.
Yeah, there are also gag orders attached to almost all of these provisions that prevent anybody who knows about that. And that also includes librarians or bookstore owners who are asked to fork over your records of what you've been reading or what you've been checking out, what you've been accessing on the internet. They can't tell you that the feds have come calling either. Very, very frightening stuff. And we've already seen that in terms of the semi-unrelated development with the no-fly list, probably appropriately called it, that those kind of concerns can also be applied to political dissent. It's moving in a very frightening direction very quickly, and there is absolutely no reason to think that it will stop here. We've seen the Bush administration being very, very aggressive about pushing the envelope, getting as much as they can, and they're continuing to do it, and they're meeting no real political opposition from either the Democrats or the Republicans. The Democrats, remember, still control the Senate that passed the Homeland Security bill this past week. And that brings us to the Homeland Security bill and the Information Awareness Office of the Pentagon, which were probably the two biggest stories of the week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Information Office at the Pentagon is Information Awareness Office?
Information Awareness Office, yeah.
And then the
proposed system that the Poindexter is trying to develop is the Total Information Awareness System. They do love their acronyms.
And we're not talking about a New Age conference here.
No, we're also not talking about considering all points of view.
No. No, and it's basically allowing government agencies that have never had this power before to access to data that most people would consider extremely private. It violates the Constitution, your right against your right to be free of unreasonable search and seizure.
Yeah, which is the same issue with the sneak and peeks. I mean, sneak, search, and peek, seizure. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it's pretty clear.
Right, and while none of these things have been talked about when the media has been covering the Homeland Security bill and some of these issues have come up, they run some articles but not talked about the privacy issues involved. They also haven't talked about what other things the Senate has been doing while it's been in its lame duck session, including passing the terrorism insurance bill, which I have to tell you has to be like the most useless piece of legislation.
If you're an insurance industry executive, it's not useless.
It passed 86 to 11 in the Senate. It's basically a handout to the insurance industry, $100 billion over 3 years to cover 90% of any future terrorism-related claims. And supposedly this is needed because construction projects couldn't go ahead because they couldn't get terrorism insurance, although the backers of this bill couldn't provide anybody with a list of projects that have been stalled because of it. Anyway, the money isn't going to cover any of the September 11th damage. No, the insurance industry has already covered that estimated $50 billion in claims already and without any problems. The real issue is that businesses are now paying more for terrorism insurance, for professional liability insurance, for malpractice insurance, because the insurance industry has used September 11th as a reason to jack up rates all across the board for every kind of insurance you can take out. And that's one of the reasons why there's been pressure by businesses to push this bill.
Including any number of insurance areas that have nothing to do with either terrorism or September 11th.
Yeah, professional liability insurance, for example, has absolutely nothing to do with a terrorist attack. It covers what your company may or may not do in the course of its normal business practices if, for example, you make a mistake in providing services to a client and the client sues you, then you're covered by your professional liability insurance. That has absolutely nothing to do with a terrorist attack. Yet those rates have gone sky high in the last year or two since 9/11. And what I find interesting is that the Senate and Washington D.C. instead of trying to put limits on the insurance industry are actually rewarding them with this bill. So that's what our senators have been doing.
And isn't that an instructive lesson for other industries?
It's like, you know. It is. And the interesting thing is that there are some very important things that the Senate didn't get to that they should have. And one of the biggest things is to pass appropriations bills. Only two appropriations bills have passed this year. No budget bill has passed. This is the first year in the modern budget process that Congress has not passed a budget bill. It really is malpractice. It really is bad.
Raising the need for professional liability.
They do. Perhaps that's why they passed the insurance bill. They figured they'd be sued for malpractice. I don't know.
They wrote the laws to exempt themselves.
Exactly.
They can't be sued, unfortunately.
But the really interesting thing is that the only two appropriations bills that have passed are the Pentagon's bill and the bill for military construction, which shows
Haven't you heard those are the only things they'll be spending money on this year?
Shows you what the priorities are for this Congress.
And they also did not do anything to extend the unemployment benefits for a number of workers whose benefits will run out on December 28th. And, you know, for people who are wondering what was passed in the Homeland bill, I mean, there was an amazing range of pork that was also passed in that bill. That was done at the same time as the insurance industry got its big fat gift, and there was the appropriations for the Information Awareness Office, and I have which
was in the Pentagon bill.
Yeah, it was, and I have a column up at workingforchange.com now because you know I really don't think that a number of people have really internalized what kind of information the Pentagon has access to. So I started out the column by describing a day. You know, I went to such and such a gas station and bought this much unleaded with my credit card and then went by and picked up my prescriptions at the pharmacy and these were the prescriptions and what they were. And then, you know, I stopped by this office and had a meeting with such and such. I went home and down and sold my files on my inbox, you know, and go through all of these lists of very normal things that almost everybody in our modern age does in the course of our average day. And the kicker is that every single piece of that information is information that the government will now have, and not may, but will, assuming the technological problems can be solved and the funding continues, will have access to that information for every U.S. citizen.
And it's clear the funding is going to continue because
yes.
That's the only thing that got funded in this year's Congress.
Yeah, and
was the
and the other piece of that is who's running the program. This is a man who you know is uniquely unqualified to be trusted with state secrets. I mean, John Poindexter was a man who you know for people who don't remember or who are too young then, in about 15 years ago during the Reagan administration, was the brain trust who literally came up with the arms for hostages scheme in Iran-Contra, which Iran was then our enemy. Saddam Hussein was then our ally in the war between Iraq and Iran, and we were funneling all sorts of weapons to him. At the time, he was using weapons of mass destruction, but that seems to be related to another issue that's popping up these days. At the time, our enemy was Iran, stemming from the revolution that deposed the Shah and the hostage crisis and so forth. And yet, Poindexter saw fit to ship weapons to Iran. Our sort of state policy was, why don't those two just kill each other? And then use the illicit, illegally obtained proceeds from those arms sale to fund the Contra Army in Nicaragua, which was then also a violation of not only international but congressional law because there was a ban on that particular year as well. In future years, they didn't have those kind of funding concerns because Congress caved. But he was convicted of lying to Congress on that and also of shredding documents so as to cover up the full extent of what the Reagan administration did. It was never fully discovered. That conviction was overturned on a technicality, namely that it used some of his testimony before Congress, and people have immunity when testifying before Congress. But there was never any question that that was, in fact, what he did.
That the guy is guilty.
Yeah, that the guy is guilty. So here you have the Bush administration taking that not as disqualification from office. They not only, I don't even think it wasn't care, they probably considered it a character reference that he went ahead and did this and was willing to, you know, make the same sort of constitution-shredding grab for power that the Bush administration now seems very enamored of as well. And a man who has been convicted feloniously of crimes that basically add up to complete disregard for constitutional processes is not the, you know, probably the last person that you would want in charge of this kind of information and this kind of project.
But I think the Bush administration views the Iran-Contra days as the glory days.
Very, you know? Well, I think they view the Nixon White House as the glory days. but yeah, it's you know, it's the same kind of thing.
Yeah, you have to wonder with Poindexter's illustrious history and the current state of computer databases that the White House must have, you know. I mean, if that guy doesn't get flagged for pulling over to the side and asking a few questions, what is going to be the criteria for flagging people in this new database? It must be all law-abiding citizens.
I mean, you know, what is the truism when electronic transfers are outlawed, only outlaws will be making electronic transfers, something like that. But it's very, very, very frightening that these are the kind of men who are not only wanting this kind of power but getting it, and who are not being challenged by people, with very few exceptions. I mean, there are some conservative, you know, civil liberties, libertarian types, and there are some liberal Democrats. But basically, within the halls of power in D.C., this is a very, very popular scheme.
Yeah, and the fact that the media isn't picking it up is I guess, par for the course. We should be used to that by now.
Well, par for the course and alarming. Take your pick, and I think they both apply.
All right. Moving along, another thing that was happening this week for a lot of things that didn't happen in D.C., it looks like they're successfully gutting the Clean Air Bill.
Yeah, and they did it on the sly. They did it when Bush was out of town, and Christy Todd Whitman, the head of the EPA, was not even there at the press conference. It was an assistant administrator. They didn't allow any photos in the conference. It was just reporters and this minor bureaucrat who sat down and announced that the EPA had changed the clean air laws.
Was supposed to do that.
Just changed them. We've gutted the clean air laws. So the new rules were issued yesterday that make it easier for utility companies, refinery operators, and manufacturing plants to expand production without installing any new emissions technology. They also raised the bar on what would be considered excess emissions. So now you've got all of the states, you've got particularly the states in New England and along the eastern seaboard are in an uproar, because now the federal government's laws are laxer than the state laws, and there's going to be pressure put on states to change their clean air laws and do the same thing, to relax them.
And for anybody listening to the government's rhetoric about how this will actually, you know, spur competition and give companies incentives to clean up their act, and I mean, this sort of the basic Republican line. Look at how well it worked in Texas. And for anybody who doubts this, I suggest they read any of Molly Ivan's back catalog of columns. You know, Texas is major cities, and I lived in Houston for several years. In fact, I worked in some of the petrochemical factories down there doing industrial hygiene education. And, I mean, it is, and particularly during Governor Bush's reign, became Houston and Dallas in particular, two of the dirtiest cities for air pollution in the United States, and it was directly attributable to exactly this sort of scheme applied at the statewide level in Texas. It was a massive gift there to the oil and fossil fuel burning industries, and that's exactly what it is nationally at this point as well. And I remember very clearly you know, being on this program and Maria and I both doing the research and writing about 2 years ago the background of a number of Bush's cabinet appointees, including Christy Todd Whitman. And most environmentalists at the time were making a big deal about the fight for Gail Norton's
to the Interior Department.
Interior Department mm-hmm. appointments. And also, of course, John Ashcroft was receiving a lot of attention. And much of what we were writing and saying at the time was, look, a number of these other appointees also have very, very troubling records. And Whitman had a very troubling record in New Jersey, also a heavy industrial state. I mean, she was governor there for a term and a half, I believe. Mm-hmm. Also a very heavily industrialized state, also a state in which pollution controls were notably loosened under her reign as governor, with disastrous results for the environment. So this is where we are nationally now. This is our future. And for a metropolitan area like the Puget Sound, which does not obviously have a lot of the same kind of fossil fuel burning plants, upwind kind of considerations that the northeastern states have, what we have is air pollution and temperature inversions and traffic. But even a little bit of loosening of those type of regulations can add
a
really nasty mix to what is already a precarious situation for our own air quality. So it's not just the northeastern United States that are at risk from this. It's all of us.
And not just our air quality, but our water quality as well. Folks who have been reading the PI this week have seen the articles on their, they've done a 6-month investigation into the water quality in Puget Sound, and one of the conclusions is that it's affected by our air quality, that a lot of the particulate matter in the air ends up in the water, and that's one of the reasons why we have such poor water quality in the Sound.
Yeah, it really is. It goes back to an environmental truism that that was really popular in the early 70s when the modern environmental movement got its start, and really seems to have been forgotten both by media outlets, by politicians, and certainly by the corporate-funded scientists at places like major universities like UW and the National Academy of Sciences and such. And that truism is that everything is connected to everything, and there is so much of how our natural environment works that we simply just still don't understand. It's a body of knowledge that we're constantly revising as we figure out new things. And we're offering figuring them out in reaction to the unintended consequences of things that we did without realizing we were doing it. This is a classic case of that, and it's really, really going to make a major difference in the future. And it was done, I mean, it's not like Congress has been, making any kind of major stand against any of these kind of initiatives from the Bush administration, but it was done administratively. It was done without even consulting another branch of the government at all.
Well, sticking with the subject of environment and energy, I understand there's been some discovery of some new oil deposits off the coast of Spain.
Yes, indeed, there have. It's really not something to laugh about. This is actually the Prestige oil tanker.
Twice the size of Valdez, Exxon Valdez.
Yeah,
it
was a single hull oil tanker that got a rip in its side sometime about a week and a half ago, and then on Tuesday, after 5 days of Spanish authorities stupidly trying to tow it out to sea, it structurally came apart, ripped in two, and sank to the bottom, leaving a 17-mile oil slick and 7 other smaller slicks headed towards the coast of Spain. Now, this tanker was carrying twice the amount of oil that the Exxon Valdez was. It's a much worse type of oil, a very heavy fuel oil that is not easily dispersed by either wind and wave action or by any sort of man-made actions that can be taken to try to disperse it. And
it's now at the bottom, so it'll circulate much more widely, right?
Right, and experts have been saying that they think the fact that the oil tanker has sunk to the bottom of the ocean, that it's very cold down there, that they think the oil will solidify. Well, that term is misleading. Solidify is not what happens to oil at the bottom of the sea. What happens is it turns into a gel, but this gel is still lighter than water. What's really holding the oil down at the bottom is the structural integrity of what's left of the two pieces of the oil tanker. Now, it's helpful to know some facts about that oil tanker. It's 26 years old. Most shipping authorities consider the reasonable life for a tanker of its size to be about 20 years. So it's being used beyond its natural lifespan, but it's not the only one. Approximately 50 to 60% of the oil tankers on our oceans are single-hulled tankers, and many, 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 many of them were built in the 1970s and earlier. There are even some oil tankers out there that were built in the 1950s that are still sailing our seas. Another thing that's interesting about the Prestige is that it has been able to avoid inspections. Its last full inspection was in 1999, 3 years ago. And since then, in a minor inspection in the States, it was found that there were cracks in the hull. So the owners knew that there were problems with this single-hulled tanker. They had it welded in China, so it had some of those cracks repaired in China, and then they filled it full of heavy fuel oil and sent it off to Europe. And many people are speculating that what happened is those welds gave out, and that's what caused this disaster. But it's interesting, I mentioned that the Spanish authorities really, they had one choice when it started to leak, and that choice was to bring it into port where it could be isolated in one area, where booms could be thrown up in relatively calm water, and where they could send another empty ship to pump its load off of it and really try to deal with it that way. Instead, they chose to tow it out to sea. Now, in other parts of the world, that might have worked. But in this part of the world, the winds and the tides predominantly move in towards the coast. So towing it out to sea really made the problem much, 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 much worse. It's also the type of oil that leaked is going to be very, very, very hard to deal with. They can't burn it off because most of its volatile components have been removed. They can't throw chemicals down on it that will disperse it because of the heaviness of the oil itself. And pretty much it's just people with buckets and with shovels out there trying to deal with it as it comes ashore. Now, the impact of this disaster, it's going to be probably the worst environmental oil spill in history at this point. It's not going to be the last, and there may be worse to come, but it is the worst in history so far. Pretty much it's going to destroy the fishing and shellfish industry over at least a 200-mile stretch of coastline that's very, very rich, probably one of the richest regions in Europe. It's going to destroy everything from mussels, clams, crabs, and oysters to most of the birds that overwinter in the North Atlantic, overwinter in areas like this, and particularly in this region because it's so rich in fish and shellfish life. It's going to destroy huge populations of auks, razorbills, puffins, gulls, gannets. It could be the end of the Balearic shearwater, which is a bird that is on the endangered species list. I'm sorry. I get a little emotional talking about it, but this bird is on the endangered species list. It is probably going to be wiped out by this spill.
And you go ahead, because I wanted to.
Oh, real quick. I mean, the Exxon Valdez was, of course, tied to Exxon. Has this ship been tied to anything?
No, it's really hard to find out who the actual owners of the ship are. The ship was registered in the Bahamas. There's yet another layer of cover for this company. They registered the company itself in Liberia, and the company operates its main offices in Greece. Nobody really knows who the owners are. The owners will only be responsible for somewhere between like $25 to $40 million in damages. The costs so far have been $42 million, the cleanup costs,
and rising rapidly.
Only one oil slick has come ashore so far. There are seven more to come, and as I was reading yesterday, another oil slick had formed over the area where the ship had gone down. So anybody's hopes that the high pressures at the bottom of the ocean are going to keep the oil there, I think it's going to do the opposite. It's going to push it to the top, are just fooling themselves.
Yeah. And I also wanted to raise, and I know we're short on time, but actually my colleague at the Seattle Weekly, Eric Segudano, has been writing about this for years. This is a local issue as well. When we talk about single
people might remember the new Carissa
ships,
that broke up off the coast of Oregon.
And it has been a political football for years, getting tugboats and safety mechanisms in place out at Nia Bay. Stationing the Coast Guard out there to provide escorts for some of these tankers as they go in and out, going up to Cherry Point and some of the other delivery points coming down from Alaska and into the Puget Sound. The shipping industry has been fighting tooth and nail to avoid the extra expense that would be involved in some very, very basic safety mechanisms that are there.
Including banning single hull.
Yeah, that would be specifically intended to increase the capacity to both prevent and then be able to respond to exactly this kind of crisis.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, with that, we are unfortunately out of time. Talking again with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, who are co-editors at Eat the State. And tell our listeners where they can find Eat the State.
It is a little volunteer paper that comes out every other week or so. It is available on the web at www.eatthestate.org. Also free of charge at bookstores and libraries and cafes and wherever else our distributors remember to put us this time. We're in many libraries, especially on the east side in King County and in the Seattle system. And you can also, as I say, find us on the web or give us a call. You can subscribe through email. You can subscribe through the mail, and all that stuff is available. If you have any information, you missed any of the information on the program or would like to find out where we are or volunteer, story tips, anything like that, give us a call. The voicemail is area code 206-903-9461.